Hello, and welcome to the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. We bring Bitcoin news, hot topics of conversation, and deep dives into a variety of Bitcoin topics to you weekly. We are Coinbits, a Bitcoin financial services company. Check us out at coinbits.app. This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much. Just, you know, riding the wave of all of the optimism regarding Bitcoin, positive price action, bullish sentiment, etc.
Bitcoiners are on a tear lately with making really strongly optimistic content. It's really nice to be able to be in the I told you so camp, back in the I told you so camp, instead of constantly playing defense. Like, we stuck through this for the last couple of years and keep, you know, we're involved in the community and still making content and talking to people and building products. And we can, you know, you can do it. It's just not as pleasant as when things are going the way Bitcoin's way again. So it's so nice to be kind of back on top.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing, there are so many factors that have contributed to the positive price appreciation that we've seen over the last year, a few months. But one thing in particular I was thinking about earlier today was that for most of Bitcoin's, you know, life, it existed in an artificially low interest rate environment. So people were like jumping out on the risk curve. They were, you know, trying to beat inflation and this easy money era. Really, there's so much liquidity sloshing around that drove people into all sorts of things. And that gave a lot of ammo to Bitcoin's critics, who then, you know, claimed that, like, that's only because there's so much liquidity in the system and some of it's going into Bitcoin, this thing with a fixed supply, and that's what's boosting the price. But since 2022, when interest rates have popped back up, Bitcoin didn't, you know, it didn't crumble, it didn't fail, and it has risen in price in a high interest rate environment, basically passing that test that a lot of people predicted it would really just like kind of fade away.
Yeah, well, not only that, but I mean, I would take it a step further. It shows that the narrative around Bitcoin's price appreciation being a result of an easy money policy is just wrong. I mean, that was a correlation without causation. Obviously, this is a complex system and there are many factors that are, you know, feeding back on each other. So I'm not saying that interest rates have no effect on the price of Bitcoin or other assets. Obviously they do, but the prevailing narrative, even in my head, back when there was this bull run during COVID, was that Bitcoin's meteoric rise had, you know, was really just a result of so many dollars being printed that they were being stuffed into every corner of the economy, including in Bitcoin. Now you see that that's just not the case. And I do have a contact who is always convinced that that was not the case, and he's been proven right. So you know who you are. Shout out. I won't dox you. But what he said was the futures product by CME was a futures ETF, and it coincided almost exactly with the all-time high, and that the reason for the turnaround in Bitcoin's bull run back then, it was going to explode even higher. And you had companies like MicroStrategy and even Elon Musk getting in at a time when it really seemed like there was going to be a run to 100K at least. I remember 200K by conference day. That was Odell's thing, because it was a reasonable expectation based on the environment we were in. It wasn't, I don't think it was just hopium. I think it was reasonable. And anyway, one narrative which has not yet been proven wrong, which has sort of gained credence in my mind, is that this, you know, the availability of futures ETFs was done in order to stop that bull run in its tracks because everything was getting a little too out of control. And it looked like maybe Bitcoin was finally going to break through into the stratosphere and, you know, mortally wound the fiat apparatus's ability to control asset prices. And so is that possibly true? I mean, very well, maybe now that we have the spot ETFs in Bitcoin, I wonder how that also plays in to that dynamic. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't have tangible thoughts on the futures perspective. I think that that's entirely possible. I will say that it's interesting as of right now, everything with the spot ETFs and Bitcoin is, you know, very woohoo, this is wonderful. Look at all of this demand. And it is driving a lot of demand. I think that these spot ETFs have been, you know, gangbusters in terms of supply, and they'll likely be like the most popular ETFs of the year. And be record setting and you know, force these issuers to buy a lot of Bitcoin, which will be interesting around the halving when it might actually save a lot of miners who might be negatively affected by their mining income, you know, being cut significantly because of the halving of the block reward.
Speaking of miners, so I saw this week that looks like Marathon is looking to expand it into other countries. What's the story there?
Yeah, so Marathon is looking to go into the UAE, Paraguay, Africa, and I think that this makes a lot of sense for miners to, especially the publicly traded ones that might have like excess cash and they just need to grow. And they should go abroad to find these cheap energy sources. And it makes a lot of sense. And especially countries that want to take advantage of the energy, like grid stabilization that miners provide. It's just a win-win for all parties. And then also the negative regulatory environment that is being, you know, spun up or exists in the US is definitely.
Well, it definitely exists. And then it was crystallized with this executive order. I think was it an EO? It was some directive for miners to provide pretty much KYB information to the government and information about their operations, right? And it was done under the auspices of this word, an emergency, public emergency, which is just at this point so abused that it's really like the boy who cried wolf. I mean, if they're going to turn this everything into an emergency, God forbid there's a real emergency and everybody just ignores them when they really shouldn't. It's very dangerous what they're doing, devaluing the word emergency like that. But anyway, they're calling it a public emergency because Bitcoin uses a lot of energy. If you know Bitcoin and you know us, you know that energy usage is considered a great an indicator of civilization and high quality of life. And the fact that Bitcoin uses so much energy is a market signal that it is valued more than other uses of that energy. And so it must mean that Bitcoin is highly, highly valued in the market. But anyway, they're calling it an emergency because Bitcoin is using all of this energy.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. And touching on your comment about the debasement of words is really what it is. It's like the similarly with there's a good article about I think a month ago in the Wall Street Journal about how the word democracy is basically meaningless nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's not used in the context of what we learn about in school, aka like, you know, a system of voting and participation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's really, you know, whatever certain people want is what democracy is. And there's so many words like that's happened to. It's really bad.
Well, yeah. Well, no, but you know what's interesting about what you're saying? I've never really thought about that. Debasement. We talk about it all the time, the debasing of fiat currency. But there's also, you know, anytime you see a movie or a show or a commercial that pushes the boundaries of acceptable discourse, that's debasement of the culture. Mm-hmm. Like, that's like saying, okay, we're going to take this thing and subvert it and debase it in order to get engagement, because basically debasement is a way of like generating a magnetic field towards something, right? Like you debase something and it attracts eyeballs and thought cycles and labor dollars. And so I think we used to just not do that because there was a cultural norm around not debasing things, because we understood that, I suppose we were just passed down through these concepts of like traditional thinking that debasement is generally frowned upon. And if you're going to participate in that, you're going to be in some sense, I suppose, ostracized or punished by people in the culture, but that's gone. So now it's like the race to find new things to debase and to use that magnetic field to like pull resources towards you and your organization. And, you know, debasement of the money is actually not unique from debasement of other words.
Yeah. And language, just language, really. Yeah. And yeah. I think that it's like the debasement of money, the debasement of language is a tool. And it's a tool that we've seen. I mean, you said that emergency has been overused, but so is pandemic. I mean, there's like a COVID pandemic, there's a gun pandemic, there's this pandemic, there's an obesity pandemic, and all of a sudden, everything's a pandemic.
Yeah. It used to be war on, like war on poverty, war on drugs.
That's now another one. Yeah. 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 There's, so it's like we're in a constant state of emergency, pandemic, in war.
Yeah. Actually, now we're going down the rabbit hole, but that has its roots even in Soviet socialist thought. The idea of the revolution is always ongoing, both internally and externally. And a revolution is a state. It's not a transition to a new state.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Dark stuff.
Well, it's all connected, though. And yeah, it really is like people who understand Bitcoin understand that it's connected to all these things. And that's why they hate it, right? That's why authorities have to play nicely with it, because they ultimately don't have much power over it, but they also don't like it. And so these things come out like miners are causing a public emergency, and it just shows their true colors. But anyway, going back to the miners moving overseas because of all this, something that came up too this week was that there is a group of, is it Hong Kongers that are moving into Ethiopia and building mining infrastructure there?
It looks like it's a Hong Kong-based company. I'm not sure if the Hong Kong company is in fact, you know, backed or like part of the Chinese government. Unsure whether it's a private entity or not. However, they have...
It's Hong Kong West Data Group.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they are basically building infrastructure in Ethiopia for Bitcoin mining and AI operations. Basically, energy for compute. Mm-hmm. And compute in terms of profitable segments that it can be channeled to today, it are AI and Bitcoin mining. And so it seems like a good thing for Ethiopia if they have, you know, competitive energy prices.
Ethiopia, I didn't appreciate until I recently read a book on geography and how it affects geopolitics called Prisoners of Geography. Good book, is written a few years ago. And it talked a little bit about Africa, but how Ethiopia is sometimes called Africa's water tower. So it kind of geographically stands above the countries below, Kenya and Tanzania, and the Nile flows down through it. And they have a lot of kind of sway over that water, both its ability to generate power and its ability to generate, to provide water, right?
Yeah.
So Ethiopia, so in a world where, you know, where stranded energy is kind of exploited on site, and some of the difficulty with moving stranded energy two population centers, which has always been the problem in the past. You know, you it's fine to say I have this volcano over here, or I have this waterfall over here, and I can extract energy from it. But if you can't build the infrastructure to move the energy to population centers, then it remains stranded. Bitcoin mining changes that dynamic. So now you're able to build energy infrastructure on site at these stranded energy, these locations. And so it'll be interesting to watch Ethiopia as sort of a case study in this, and to see whether, you know, how that works for them. I know that, you know, we had that happen in El Salvador with the volcano. Actually, I haven't heard about that project in a while. I don't know if there's an update on that. But
I believe the bonds were available for sale. And I think you could buy the bonds, the volcano bonds, to fund the various projects. And I'm unsure about the status of the construction or any of that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, so speaking of people who love Bitcoin, what did Biden do this week?
Yeah. So this was interesting. There were a lot of articles written about this. And I think that the consensus take is that this was not a pro-Bitcoin post. However, Joe Biden, president of the United States, tweeted an image of himself with the Bitcoin laser eyes, and the caption was "just like we drew it up." And I want to say that, as far as I can tell, and I've researched this, the laser eyes meme originated with Bitcoiners. It is a Bitcoin meme that has since grown to other parts of the internet. And I think that this, with this attempt, the Biden team was trying to portray Biden as this like dark Brandon figure, where he leans into the ironically, it's kind of like ironic authoritarianism as an aesthetic, basically,
right?
Which, you know, authoritarianism is not Bitcoin, but anyway, it's a whole mess. But yeah, interesting signals coming there from there.
Do you think that he's saying that he's Satoshi? No. Okay. All right.
I don't think so.
That's a high likelihood. Okay. So ETFs are still high top of mind. There's 10 times as much demand for Bitcoin coming into these ETFs as there is supply coming in from natural sellers, who are the miners, says Michael Saylor on CNBC this week.
Yeah, that was huge. And I think that what's also interesting is that MicroStrategy this week has had such a windfall from their Bitcoin buys that it's now it's now included in the S&P 500. I don't know if the S&P 500 is an exact, you know, match to the Fortune 500, or what the relationship is between there, but I know that MicroStrategy its stock has done well, and like the company has done well because of these Bitcoin buys.
Does that mean that it's automatically included in index funds that track the S&P?
I think so. I think that the company S&P Global constructs the indices. I know that because I read that one of their index people got in trouble for like trying to front run those additions with his like own portfolio. Right. Kind of like, if you remember, like I think it was Coinbase. Yeah, it's like that product guy from Coinbase was trying to like front run the altcoins that were listed. You remember the Coinbase pump was whenever your like alt token got listed on Coinbase.
Okay. That's interesting, because what will happen, and one of the things that I think I've heard people talk about with the ETF, but I'm really hoping works out the way that we predict. And by the way, I'm the last person you should listen to about predictions. I do my best, but like I'm often wrong, even though my arguments seem logical. However, it seems as if the inflows into the ETFs may dampen volatility, right? So think about the difference between the person buying and selling on an exchange versus buying and selling at a brokerage. So on an exchange, you're thinking in dollars, you have a million different coins to be trading in and out of, and you're trying to maximize dollar returns, usually for short-term gain. When you're talking about these ETFs, they're typically in, a lot of them are in tax advantaged accounts, which means that you can't withdraw and convert to dollars until some time period, right? Until you are eligible to retire. And what that means is you're automatically kind of holding for a longer term. Now, you could sell the ETF shares inside that account and trade them for a different share, but you're not looking to kind of cash your money out of the Bitcoin investment. And what's interesting too is people who are investing for retirement, a lot of them are thinking in terms of percentages instead of dollars. So they want the overall number of dollars to rise, but they want the percent of the different asset types in the account to remain relatively stable. So if they have decided that their strategy is to own 5% of Bitcoin in their portfolio rather will be 5% Bitcoin. If Bitcoin's price rises a lot and that becomes 10%, they may actually convert some of those shares.
Yeah, they'll rebalance.
To something else, which is like kind of bad, quote unquote, right? Because now you're selling Bitcoin, but there's always a buyer on the other side of that. And that process only happens once a year, roughly, right? And so people who rebalance yearly, you're just going to see, I think, a lot more consistent and predictable entry and exit from Bitcoin. And I think that's good. Because the monkey brain that people have, that where like they know they're supposed to hodl, but you know, if you see a lot of volatility, it's scary for a lot of people, not for hardcore Bitcoiners, but for a lot of people. So if that volatility goes down, adoption goes up, right? And then there's a flywheel there where adoption rises slowly and steadily as volatility decreases, and you just have this nice appreciation over the long term.
Yeah. I like your use of flywheel. I've been thinking more in terms of flywheels. It's a very cool. So moving on from MicroStrategy, FutureBit is Bitcoin education, and they are collaborating with U.S. universities, Rutgers being the first to provide education on decentralized systems through hands-on learning experiences. That's very cool. I also saw a few months ago, or maybe a month ago, there's a student at Cornell that's doing some sort of interdisciplinary major in Bitcoin, which is interesting to see. Then Bitcoin Magazine and White Rock Management are opening an office in Switzerland. Nice to see that team is expanding. And then also Founders Fund by Peter, which is Peter Thiel's, it's one of those like fancy VCs. They have invested $100 million of one of their funds just into Bitcoin, which is interesting.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. I think that Founders Fund actually like exited before the last major drawdown. They like had a position in Bitcoin and then they sold it. So interesting timing that like they're getting in right now.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. All right. Well, to kind of move things along, we did want to talk about Bitcoin as being kind of an outlet for expressing your values, but also for an outlet for your wealth and your protecting yourself. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So really what I think is so interesting about this concept and Bitcoin in general is that Bitcoin enables people to put their ideas into practice, mm-hmm. especially when they're really like fed up with, you know, the system or things that are happening around them that they might not know like exactly what's going on, but they know that something's not right, especially with respect to the financial system. And we saw this a lot during Occupy Wall Street and even the GameStop frenzy and similar movements where people get really up in arms about central banking and all the harms that have been done to them. And they just complain a lot about it and then nothing happens. Yeah. And now they have Bitcoin. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about that and kind of following up.
Yeah, no. Well, what's wonderful about Bitcoin is that it is doing two things at once. So it's a protest, but it's also a practical step. So, you know, there's a lot of energy out there on all sides of political issues to protest, to express yourself, to do something, right? And a lot of the tactics that, that people use, some of it's good. People who understand the political system can influence politicians and the political process, are able to drive change. But there's a lot of sort of wasted energy, I guess. And there's a lot of people who are too busy to do that stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're actually out there earning a living and raising a family. And so Bitcoin is great because it's a relatively low effort thing to do. I mean, you do have to, you do have to be educated enough that you're committed and that you understand what it is. Because otherwise, if you're not committed, you know, you're going to, as soon as there's like bad news, like, oh my God, Biden is asking for miners information, you're going to like maybe freak out and like get out, right?
Yeah.
So you have to understand it well enough that you aren't scared of sort of the head fakes that are constantly being thrown your way. But you don't have to do much more than just buy a little tiny bit and then hold on to it. Like that's it. That's the protest. There's no marching. There's no, you know, holding signs and yelling, and there's no getting in trouble with the authorities or like going online and writing screeds. It's just like, you take some of the money that you earn that represents your labor and your talent, and you put it over here. And over here is outside the purview of this broken, unethical system. And that's kind of the beginning and the end of it. And I think people should do that whether or not Bitcoin actually works out to make them wealthy in the long run, because there's like an ethical dimension to that. But it just so happens that if you understand Bitcoin deeply, you understand that it's very likely that as Bitcoin monetizes, that will also benefit you over the long term. And so it's just a really, really powerful tool. It's a protest with teeth.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's basically like, you know, you're eating at a restaurant with your family, but the servers are so mean to you and the food is terrible. And you get like basically bullied when you're there and it's horrible. And you keep going back to it because it's like the only restaurant in town, but then there's a grocery store that opens up in town or like another restaurant. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to go to the other one that's not mean to me. And you just go because that's like,
yeah,
I thought of that just now. It's not the best.
It is. Like, it's great. You just,
but
go.
It's pretty much it. Like, it's it. Yeah.
And you have to take that step though. Like there's like this buildup. Like for me too, when I was learning about Bitcoin, it was like, I always had a little bit, but I wasn't really highly committed to it for a long time. And I was like reading, buildup. And it's finally like, you have to take action. Like now is the time to like now reorganize your life and think about it differently and really live that value. So,
yeah. If not you, then who? Parker Lewis says.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Coin check. Here's the quiz. You want to read the quiz?
Sure. When did Bitcoin's dollar exchange rate first surpass 1,000? So that's $1,000. A, November 28th, 2013. B, December 31st, 2013. C, January 3rd, 2009, and D, February 14th, 2010.
Very specific dates, but so the first two were both in 2013, and then 2009, 2010. So 2009 was the year that the Bitcoin blockchain started. So I'm going to say that's probably not it.
Yeah,
and 2010, February 14th. That's Valentine's Day 2010. I wonder what I was doing that day. I don't know. That would have been a year later. It seems still pretty optimistic.
I was probably like texting a high school girlfriend on like I don't know if I had an iPhone. I think I had one of those droids with like the biggest screen possible.
Yeah.
I remember that was like a really appealing to me.
Motorola like, droid.
Yeah.
That like, phone.
Yeah. It was, they had, They had some advantages, but for me, the iMessage was a really big kicker to make the switch. But,
interesting. Do you think, were you buying Bitcoin back then?
I wish.
Yeah.
I wish.
It probably wasn't $1,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2013, one of them, November 28th or December 31st, which one is it?
It is November 28th, 2013, when Bitcoin's dollar exchange rate passed $1,000 on Mt. Gox, which was basically like the truth for like the exchange rate of Bitcoin for dollars for many years.
That was the source of that information. Yeah. Cause it was by far the biggest exchange.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And you know what, for the people who lived through that or the people who didn't live through that, I was peripherally aware of it. It's like the collapse of Mt. Gox could have been this mortal wound, right? It's over, like Bitcoin's done. And look at how so many years later, it survived so many events like that. That's why people who've been around long enough, they don't care about these big drawdowns because they just know, you just wait. Because every day, even though they're, no matter the price, today there are more users of Bitcoin than there were yesterday. It's like it's a ratchet. And so
a lot of people like, or have bought others' claims to Mt. Gox, like out in order to accumulate Bitcoin on sale. And they are now going to reap the rewards of that.
Are they really?
Wow. Yeah. I think they're going to like get it back. And, a lot of, like whales like bought up claims.
Oh my gosh.
To get like more Bitcoin or something like that.
How are they getting it back, David?
I'm not sure.
I would love, let's look into that. I'm going to look into that too. Cause, I thought it was stolen. And so are they just, did they like chase people down and force them to give up their keys? Well, anyway, we can look it up.
It's a wormhole, but there was like some CoinDesk articles I was reading about it earlier. I believe they have some sort of, you know, creditors committees, stuff like that. And I think they've been able to recover some. So
amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's it, right? Anything else?
No, I think that's it. And would just tell everybody listening to have a wonderful week.
Yeah. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye, everyone.
Yeah. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what'd you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter @CoinbitsApp. And be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast.